Welcome to Surgical Hot Topics, a podcast series from the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. This podcast features leaders in cardiothoracic surgery discussing timely issues important to the profession and their patients. The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual participants and not necessarily that of STS. The podcast will resume after a message from our sponsor.
Structural Heart to Heart is a podcast from Boston Scientific, where your peers approach timely topics in the field. Follow as we touch on emerging trends, solutions to common challenges, and more. In a recent episode of Structural Heart to Heart, Drs. David Ryzik and Saeb Kigali join us to discuss how to remove drama from your TAVR procedures.
There's been so much evolution. There's so much less heartburn in the lab. But there are still those moments.
Hear the rest at bostonscientific.com/heart-to-heart.
Thank you for joining us at this STS video roundtable discussion. My name is Joseph Baveri from Philadelphia, and we're going to be talking today about low-risk TAVR trials and the low-risk TAVR situation regarding its place in our clinical armamentarium. It's also a part of the STS surgical hot topics issues. So we do have a very distinguished panel here to discuss this very important issue for surgeons and for interventional cardiologists across the country. I have Yoshi Kaneko from the Brigham Hospital in Boston, Vino Tirani from Atlanta, and Mike Reardon, who's been in this space for a long time from Houston, Texas. So gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. And let's just start it off by talking to Mike. Tell me what you think one of the big messages of the low-risk trials that came out at the ACC meeting, the P3 trial from Edwards, and the low-risk Evolut trial from Medtronic.
So I think, Joe, the big message is that for the patient population tested, this works very well. For surgeons, we need to understand what was the patient population tested and what are the knowledge gaps that still exist out there, really understand the status so that we can counsel our patients wisely. Once the trials came out, of course, the headline that it was superior in P3 and non-inferior in Evolut percolated throughout the community, and then people wanted to treat everybody without paying attention to the fact that it only applies to the population tested. So my goal right now is to sit down with surgeons and say, let's look at these trials. Let's look at who was tested, and more importantly, let's look at who was not tested and where our knowledge gaps exist.
When you say that's with surgeons and cardiologists, talk to both of them.
Correct. This.
Yep. So Vino, what do you think? Because you come from a little bit different. You were a major part of the P3 trial. Dr. Reardon was a major part of the Evolut trial. What's your opinion?
So I 100% agree with Mike that you really have to look at the patient population tested. And we'll go through some of this, but it didn't have those patients that had severe LVOT calcification. It didn't have patients in their 60s and 50s and even 65, right? I mean, we're talking about patients in their 70s. It didn't have anybody with a bicuspid valve. We're going to spend more time, I know, Joe, on bicuspid valve. So there are a large patient population that was not part of these trials. So I think it's the education of who had it. The results are clearly great, but let's just be honest. We all, four of us, sit in our heart teams and we meet these patients and everybody wants a TAVR, and that may be appropriate for those patients, but we have to kind of work with patients and the cardiologists and looking at the long-term therapy of what's needed.
Yoshi?
Yeah, so I think the tough part is after the ACC, these two big results that came out, eventually the FDA approved it, but the FDA approval didn't come in a specific condition. So they approved low risk. It didn't say that, you know, patients under 65 was excluded. It didn't even exclude bicuspids. So I think the difficult part is that the message that got sent out by the FDA approval was that all low risk got approved. And I think that's the part that we're still struggling to educate, especially to the cardiologists out in the reach where they refer to us. And they really don't know what were the inclusion criteria for these trials. And they have no idea. They just refer to you for TAVR.
But remember, there is a black box warning by FDA for bicuspid valves. Right. So that's not part of, you're right in the sense that it was approved, but there is a black box warning. And therefore, right, we're discussing trials that will allow us to study these patients more carefully than the 100 patient little registries that all of us do. So there's some interest in the bicuspid part of it.
Yeah, I think, Mike, why don't you just amplify for the TAVR and SAVR community this black box, this black box from the FDA regarding a kind of a warning about bicuspid aortic valve and TAVR. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, we're all treating some bicuspids in our programs. And they're generally older, and they're generally people that we really don't want to operate on, and we're getting pretty good results. I think we have to be very careful, though, as we move into younger patients, because we really don't have a knowledge of how they're going to do. I mean, in the low-risk trials, none were bicuspids excluded, but less than 7% of PARTNER 3 was less than 65, less than 6% of Evolut was less than 65. And so we get in these lower bicuspids, it becomes problematic. Right. I think that if you start talking to these people, you can tell them we can treat you, but bear in mind that when you look at things like Raj Makkar's paper from the TVT, all those patients were seen by experienced implanters and said, yes, you have a bicuspid, oh, and I think I can treat you. What we don't know is what are the denominator of all the bicuspids that got evaluated and how many got turned down. So we have to be very careful about the data that's out there. A low-risk randomized bicuspid trial would really help fill that knowledge gap.
Right. Yoshi, let's drill down a little bit here. Go through a couple of this as Dr. Reardon said, the knowledge gaps. In other words, can you drill down on a couple of the areas that were not addressed, patient populations that were not addressed in the trials?
Right.
And how you are dealing with them in your practice?
That's a very, very good question and very, you know, complicated question to answer completely. But the major ones are age under 65. They were all excluded from the trial, at least for the P3. I know that for Evolut it was a little different. So I think the age is definitely a discussion point when the patient comes to see us in clinic. So we always have a dilemma of young patients, 63-year-old, that has favorable anatomy for TAVR, tricuspid valve for the sake of discussion. And what do we do in those patients? Do you know the durability of this valve? You get that question a lot. We truly do not. And, what's the risk of getting another TAVR after the first TAVR? Is that even feasible? I think those are still unknowns that you sort of have to put into calculation to making that decision. And I think that's what is really hard. And if they have a perfect anatomy in our daily practice, even if it's age under 65, we are doing TAVRs, even right. low-risk patients.
So remind us again of what is the percentage of patients under 65 in the two trials?
For P3, it was less than 7%, and for Evolut, it's less than 6%. So our people less than 65 in both trials. Jeff Popma, Marty Leon, and Mike Mack, and I actually just wrote an editorial about looking at these gaps. So age is a gap, bicuspid's a gap. We excluded an Evolut syntax over 22, and you guys excluded, I think, over 33. But what was the syntax actual in the score? Well, in Evolut, it was 2. 2. We weren't treating any coronaries. You can tell me what it was, P3, but it was low.
It was low.
It was low. And then the other thing is that all these patients are seen by a local heart team who says, your anatomy is good for TAVR, it's good for surgery, and you meet all the inclusion-exclusion.
And went through a case review form.
And then it goes to a national screening committee where you think everybody would be accepted.
But a third of patients did not get accepted in both trials.
No, in Evolut it was 14.8, but it's 34%. Right. But again, it's clear that we're not treating everybody. And these are carefully selected people that a knowledgeable screener said, we think they're better for TAVR.
I do want to address the durability thing that since you brought that up. We just recently published presented the 5-year results using the SAPIEN XT valve, not the SAPIEN 3 valve.
Right.
There was no difference, statistical difference, when you look at aortic valve areas and mean gradients between the TAVR valve and a surgical valve at 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I do tell my patients that at 5 years, we're not seeing any difference in gradients,
right,
nor aortic valve areas compared to surgical valves. Now, mind you, that's at 5 years, and it's an older patient population, mean age is 80, versus a low-risk trials, which is mean age is in the lower 70s. So I think there are some differences in the type of patients we're talking about. But at 5 years, we're not seeing a difference. And wouldn't you say that's the same
we have Notion out
self-expanding.
Over 6 years, we have high-risk core valve out to 5 years, been published. Tom Gleason presented and published that. But again, for high risk, 84, intermediate risk, it's 80.
Right.
If we were doing surgical valves in 80-year-olds, we wouldn't expect those to roll out by 5 years either. So I tell patients right now they're tracking, but it's really, really early.
Right. And just remember that both the low-risk trials have at least commitments thus far to follow these patients for a decade from both companies, Medtronic and Edwards.
Well, and intermediate, too. The intermediate have both been moved to
right.
Tenure. Is there, Vino, you were the first author, is there any data or nuanced concepts that can inform this discussion on low risk coming out of the 5-year P2 data that you just published?
Yeah, we're I think that that data is very enlightening to me. We do see that around year three, it's not statistically significant at 5 years, but at around year 2.5 to 3, we do see some separation in mortality. And this was, remembered to remind everybody, it's a second generation Sapien XT valve, not the Sapien 3. Mm-hmm. We found out that those patients that had a lot of PVL, paravalvular regurgitation, or leakage, have a much higher mortality faster. And so it really becomes important, even with the current valves, if a core valve or a Sapien 3, you can't leave them with moderate or more leakage. They're gonna die pretty quickly. So what I gleaned out of that is that the reason the graphs are starting to separate around year three is all based around paravalvular regurgitation. Okay. So I think we have to be vigilant about that.
So in that mild PVL group, even that mild PVL group, it was not statistically significant, but it was sort of starting to show some trends.
Right.
So should we eliminate mild PVL
for low-risk patients? The goal now for low-risk patients is to have none to trace. Yeah. I think once you're starting to leave PVL, I think you're starting to get into this problem with potentially 5 or 10 years down the road having a problem. Nothing before 5 years, I think you'll really have a problem with that.
I think the other thing you ought to bear in mind with both low-risk trials is TAVR 1 in the first month on safety. After that, the curves flatten out. Right. And then the longer term, things are going to start to fall in. So both these low-risk trials, it was really the first month for TAVR 1 for mortality, for stroke, for hospitalization.
Right. One of the things we're not talking about, Joe, that concerns me about low-risk is pacemaker rates. I think that's something that I also talk to patients about. We're thinking about that more and more, because we're all seeing complications from pacemakers for a variety of reasons. Infection all the way to TR, which is a major problem. That's something also that comes into conversation with me when I'm talking to patients, specifically low-risk patients, about TAVR versus SAVR.
Yeah, I would happen to agree with you. Both of the trials showed that the pacemaker rates were lower in the surgical group, but they were not all that statistically significant in both the trials. However, if you...
That's not true.
That's true of the P3. I understand. But maybe let's discuss a little bit of the reconciliation, so to speak, between these RCTs, like these two trials, and the TVT registry, which is showing about a 12% 30-day pacemaker rate across the whole country, with 150,000 patients being examined and studied. What are your thoughts about the pacemaker rates in these lower risk patients?
Well, I mean, you prefer nobody get a pacemaker ever. You know, we would say, well, it's just a pacemaker, but you know, the pacemakers are never good if you don't have to have one. I will say that you know, Vino is right. There was no statistical difference in P3. Statistically, the TAVR lost in Evolute. Now, I looked at every site and how many cases they did, the number of pacemakers, and the more cases you did, the less pacemakers you had. So my lead enroller, Hemelgada, had 1.9% pacemaker rate out of 69 TAVR cases he did. Mine is 5.6 as the fourth leading enroller. I've done about 2,000 now. My pacemaker rate is in the single digits. So some of it for the pacemaker, it's how you implant the valve. And there are some things we're learning about how we image these, how we implant these. I think that we need to strive to get it down to zero. The other thing is that if you test these at 6 months, half of them aren't being used at all.
Yeah.
And so a better leadless pacemaker for 3 months are other things that we're all working on right now. But the key is just avoid a pacemaker.
So it does make a difference in my valve choice selection.
Absolutely.
Quite honestly, based on low-risk patients, I look at the coronaries, whether they're going to need coronaries down the road, and I look at pacemakers. And that does go into our definition of which valve we're going to use for low-risk patients, based on the RCTs, but also our own personal anecdotal experiences.
Yeah, but then you go to patient prosthetic mismatch, because then it goes the other direction. So it's a balance every time. So if I have a small wound, a small annulus, then I start thinking about, okay, what valve gives me better flows? If
Absolutely.
I have a big man, then you start thinking about, okay, maybe I need to avoid pacemakers.
Pacemakers are not that such a big deal in an 80-plus-year-old population, but they're probably a bigger deal in the younger patient. I have EPs who feel that if you're 80, 85 years old, everybody in the world should get a pacemaker.
Yeah. So, and it's amazing that we've made aortic valve replacement really it's become a very thoughtful procedure at this point, because we have so many options versus just opening them up and replacing them.
Yeah.
So I'd like to pivot a little bit into a very important subject regarding both surgical aortic valves and TAVRs. is the concept of the bicuspid aortic valve. The bicuspid aortic valve, from a TAVR and AVR standpoint, is an abnormal anatomy bicuspid AS has tremendous calcification. This has been well known for many years. 2 to 3 times more calcification for the same AVA as a three-cuspid aortic valve, it also has some issues regarding the aortopathies associated with bicuspid aortic valve. What your approach to bicuspid aortic valve is regarding TAVR in your heart team?
Yes. So, the bicuspid patients, as you know, tends to be a little younger. So age becomes more of a factor that we have to consider. But the main thing that we look at is actually the CT scan and the anatomy. I think that is critical to look at whether it's a type 0, type 1, type 2. And within the type 1, I think you really have to look at, whether the calcified RAFA is present or not. I think that is critical. If you have a really calcified RAFA, I think those are the ones that have higher chance of annular rupture, which has been described in multiple papers that are higher in bicuspid TAVRs, and also residual PVL. And for young patients to leave PVL, as we had the discussion, I think will be a problem. So type 1s with significantly calcified RAFA, we actually take them to the OR at the Brigham. For type 2s, they tend to calcify, so I think those will be more suitable for surgery. Type 0, believe it or not, are actually relatively easily treated. I think their PVLs and the risk of annular rupture, I think, are low. I know that Raj's group is trying to dissect based on the morphology of the bicuspids. Mm-hmm. But I think the anatomy is critical in these patients. And going to aortopathy, I would like to ask you what we should do in, say, for instance, 65-year-old with 4.7 centimeters.
Well, that's easy. 65-year-old,
4.2.
Let's do the 4.2.
Do 4.2. 4.7 is, here comes a knife.
Yeah, well, I think that the aortopathy portion of the bicuspid aortic valve syndrome, which is a broad-based syndrome, not just about the valve, is an important concept. How to address the aortopathy does have some issues regarding size of the patient and what we call indexing. 4.2 for an average size man is probably not such a big deal in a bicuspid aortic valve. We know for a fact that if you take all bicuspid aortic valves that are totally asymptomatic out there and just do routine echoes on them, they're going to have about a 6 to 7 to 8 millimeter bigger aorta normally. This is 4.1, 4.2 is probably not such a big deal, at least especially prophylactically. 4.5 or 4.6 or bigger is definitely something you want to take care of.
If I can ask one more question. So what would you do if it was a 75 with 4.7 centimeters? Do those patients need an operation?
Yeah, 75, 4.7, you have to kind of think, well, what's the natural history today of a 75-year-old? And it's actually pretty good. It's probably about 16, 17 years on average. In other words, if you make it to 75, you're going to. So if it's 4.7 and they're pretty low risk, I would take care of that
surgically.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that.
Can I ask the two senior guys here, what are your thoughts about bicuspid aortic valve? And how you approach it in your practice, especially in your heart teams.
So I tell you, Joe, it's interesting because all of us do a lot of bicuspid valves, and we understand that bicuspid valve is not this monolith of bicuspid valves, whereas most people think it's a bicuspid valve. And there are many different phenotypes, and we look at each one of them differently. And we look at the aorta, we look at the valve, we look at the calcium. If big, where is it? Not just how much is it, but where is it located? I had a 74-year-old man show up 3 weeks ago in my office. He wanted to ride the MS-150, which is a 150-mile bike ride from Houston to Austin. He knows he was getting more tired when he rode it. And so his cardiologist echoes him, and he's got Sievert 0 with a mean gradient of 45, and his aorta is 5. But he's been sent to me and told he's going to get a TAVR. And I had to sit down and explain to him why he was going to get an operation. He, of course, did fine. This is the ideal guy. Oh, he's skinny, rides 150 miles. He gets a 27 valve. You can't miss because it's a bicuspid valve with a great big annulus. But there's a lot of misconceptions because he had already been told, even though they knew he had a bicuspid valve and knew he had a 5-centimeter aorta, that we're going to send you and they're just going to do a TAVR on you. We're still pretty aggressive about operating on the appropriate people. Right. But if you're in your mid-80s, so yeah, then it becomes a lot different. The mean age at my site for TAVR is still 81 years old.
Right.
In the same way, I believe that, you know, TAVR is appropriate for some bicuspids. When it comes to aortopathy, really surgery is the pathway. Most of my surgical cases now are bicuspid patients, quite honestly. Right. One thing I do want to mention is for those patients that do get a TAVR and have a bicuspid, I'm more likely to have neuroprotection for them through the Sentinel device. Yeah. I mean, we all know because we're surgeons, it's caseous type of calcification that we see in bicuspid valves. And I believe that there's a higher chance that you're going to have to post-dilate these patients if you're using self-expanding, maybe even for the balloon expandable. I think the stroke rate is something I get concerned about in these caseous bicuspids. So if you're going to do a TAVR in these patients, I really believe you should have a neuroprotection device for that.
Right. Well, there's a lot to talk about in the low-risk trials and what they mean for both cardiac surgical programs as well as interventional cardiology programs and, of course, the heart team. But we've run out of time, and I hope you enjoy this this podcast. And I would like to thank my faculty here who are very experienced in this space. And thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Surgical Hot Topics. If you like this podcast, please rate it and let your friends and colleagues know about it. More information about the Society of Thoracic Surgeons is available online at sts.org and on our patient website, ctsurgerypatients.org.